Kia ora, I'm Maria, I'm Māori and Pākehā.
And I'm Kate, and I'm Iranian Australian.
And you're listening to Being Biracial.
It's the podcast all about navigating the world as a mixed race person.
We want to acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on the unceded sovereign lands of the Boonwurrung and the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nation.
And we offer our respect to the elders of these lands, past, present, and also those yet to come. We also want to acknowledge the traditional custodians from the lands wherever this podcast is reaching you. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Today we are going to be chatting to Jason Om about being biracial.
Jason is an ABC journalist and an author, and we both loved and are obsessed with his memoir, All Mixed Up. Welcome to Being Biracial, Jason.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'd say I was multiracial as opposed to being biracial. Saying only two is a bit limiting.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yes.
Multiracial.
Yeah. No, I think it's something that's come up a lot for us in making this podcast. Like, the first question we always ask is, what is your mix? So maybe get into your mix and then we can get into the weeds of language.
Yes. Well, it's complicated. That's the first answer. Dad's side is Cambodian and mum's side is Eurasian-Malaysian. And on the Malaysian side, it's very complicated because, you know, my ancestors, my great-grandparents, they were all... they were mixed race. So there's one great-grandparent who's English-French, and really that side of the family, they don't really know what race they are. They will always say Eurasian. They say Portuguese-Eurasian, but they can't really pinpoint where the Portuguese came in. They can't really pinpoint where the whiteness came in, but they know that their identity is Portuguese-Eurasian. And the Eurasians are a very specific group of people. It's a tiny, tiny community in Malaysia. And they are specifically Eurasian. They identify as that. But I also have extended relatives on that side as well who are Dutch Eurasian, and they look really white, really white European. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is a complicated a mix. I see why you say multiracial.
Yes. And then on my mother's side, the daughters married out of their cultures. So mum married a Cambodian man, my auntie married a Vietnamese man, and my other auntie married a Goan man. And so all of my cousins are all different, you know, culturally different, yet the same.
As a journalist, is getting that language precise really important to you around race?
I'm not really sure because I identify as... so, for example, you can call me mixed race, but then you can also call me Asian because both of my parents are from Asia, right? But when I was growing up, the Cambodian side would always say to me, oh, you're white. You know, look at your mum, look at your grandma, you're white. But that's not completely inaccurate.
Yeah.
Because I'm not white in the Australian sense of the word. You know, I'm not Anglo-Australian. But to their eyes, because mum was Eurasian, they thought that they're European, right?
Mm.
But it's not the case. For example, in the book, there's a photo of my grandmother. And if you look at that photo, she looks very European. She's got dark curly hair. And walking around the streets of Oakley back in the day, she would have passed as a European woman.
How did that dynamic, like, in terms of racial hierarchies in the Malaysian context, like, where do the Eurasians sit?
So in Malaysia, there are three main groups. There are the Malays, there are the Indians and the Chinese, and then the Eurasians are in there, but they're so small that they don't really sort of factor in. And the stories that my auntie tells me is that they were treated as second-class citizens. They weren't even really recognised because the majority culture there is the Malays. You know, Malaysia is a multiracial nation, but there are unspoken tensions between those groups, and you're not supposed to talk about it. if you're Malaysian, you don't talk about it. And certainly my family didn't want to talk about those tensions either.
So interesting. And so then do you think because your mum's family was from this already very multiracial context, did that kind of set the scene for then the daughters, I guess, to all marry outside of their cultures? Because that's quite interesting in itself.
I think it was an act of rebellion against my grandmother because Nan was very strict. She was a fanatical Catholic, and so she had a very clear idea of who the daughters should marry. She wanted them to marry Catholic men. So I think it was an act of rebellion because they all rebelled, really. And when I speak to my aunties about their marriages, they all say that Nan disapproved of their marriages. They disapproved of my Goan uncle, my Vietnamese uncle, my dad. And in my dad's case, in my mum and dad's case, Nan wanted mum to marry a white man when mum came to Australia. That's what she wanted. That she had that idea. Which again to me is very strange because we're all, you know, my family's mixed race, yet here the matriarch is saying you need to marry a white man. So that's racist in itself. Like you've got an idea that you should marry a European, a proper European.
Mm. Yeah. Is that something you've talked to your mum about in terms of how, for the broader family, like how was your parents' marriage received?
My parents weren't married,
okay.
But I don't think there was actually too much of an issue with it. My mum hasn't said anything about it that, you know, because my grandparents on mum's side weren't religious, so they weren't, you know, tied to anything specifically. But when I've asked her, I'm like, was it controversial? And she's like, nah, it was fine. And I was like, are you sure about that, Rowan?
Yeah, well, certainly in mum's case, it was very controversial. Her first marriage was controversial. So her first marriage was to a Malay, and Malays are Muslim. And so that was a huge controversy on that side of the family because it defied Nan's religion. That was a huge rift that marriage caused. And at that time in the 60s, I think it was a bit taboo for a young Catholic woman to go and run off. And my mum did run off with this Muslim man and not tell the family as well. So very controversial.
How did she get to Australia, your mum?
So mum came to Australia in the 1970s and she came here for family reunion reasons. And that in itself is a very complicated story. Mum ran off with this Muslim man. They had a daughter, my half-sister, and she fled that marriage. And by that stage, the rest of mum's family had already moved to Australia. And Nan ordered mum to Australia to leave Malaysia, leave her daughter behind, leave that marriage and move to Australia. So it was it wasn't the typical migrant narrative of coming to Australia for a better life. It was actually really traumatic. Whereas Dad's story is more along the lines of looking for a better life because he came here as an international student in the 1960s. But Dad never actually intended to stay in Australia, but historical events in Cambodia, the disasters that happened there and the war, meant that he was stuck. And that's how my parents met.
Mm. Yeah. And one of the sliding door moments for me when I was reading your book was when your dad decides to put an ad in the newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. So my parents met through a newspaper, through the personal ads in a newspaper. So Dad was still studying and he was looking for love and he placed a personals ad in the newspaper and he didn't really have much luck. He went through several women and mum was, you know, mum was the one, obviously. But there were women who took the piss out of him. And Dad sort of recounts that as, oh, you know, he turned up on the doorstep and it was a joke. They were, you know, making fun of him. But when I look at that story, I sort of think in the context, I think it was actually a racist joke. But after all those women, he finally met Mum, and they met, their first date was on the steps of Flinders Street Station, and they went back to his place in Caulfield. I guess they just had a bit of chit-chat. They had a bit of chit-chat, you know, nothing happened. I did ask my dad, I said, well, what actually happened? Did anything happen? You know, was I conceived? Was I conceived from that day? And it didn't really enter his mind. But, you know, I have to ask these things when I'm writing it. Like, I need to understand what was going on.
I feel like it's like a, it's kind of like putting a personal ad. It's kind of like Tinder.
It is. It is the old way. You know, today it's Tinder and apps and, but that's the way they people met.
That's so cute. And what was your experience growing up in Melbourne?
I grew up in Oakley in the southeastern suburbs, and it was, I guess, in terms of culture, it was very confusing because, you know, Kate, you talked about how it was very complicated on the Malaysian side, and I had a very strong sense that I was Australian because, you know, you go to school and you have that sense that we are Australia, and you know that was the 1980s, and there's a real strong sense of social cohesion under the umbrella of multiculturalism, and so I had a very strong sense of being Australian, but at the same time it was very confusing because I hung out with my Cambodian cousins who I felt were very different from me. They were more Cambodian than me. They spoke the language. They had all these sort of cultural trinkets in their lounge room, whereas we didn't really have that. I mean, Dad had like a picture of Angkor Wat on the wall, but we weren't a very, you know, very strongly Asian household, whereas they were. So, and also Dad wanted me to learn the language, but I sort of pushed back. He wanted me to go to Cambodian school. My cousins were forced to go to Cambodian school and learn the language, but I wasn't. And I had all these kind of exemptions from, you know, cultural exemptions where I'd didn't have to take my shoes off when I went to Cambodian houses, where I, you know, didn't have to learn the language, where I didn't have to greet people in the traditional greetings. You know, I didn't have those traditions. So it was kind of confusing because it was that, and then Mum's side, which was Eurasian, which was more aligned to the Western style of living, yet they would eat curry and they would, you know, like it was... Yeah, it was a little bit confusing. Yeah.
Why do you think you had those exemptions?
I had those exemptions because the Cambodian side viewed me as Australian and also Malaysian. So whenever I would turn up to these Cambodian houses, they would always look at me and go, "Who is? Why does he look that way?" And and Dad would always explain his mother is Malaysian. And there was always that explanation when I would turn up, and then I would be treated differently. Because I'm not fully Cambodian and I had these exemptions. But at the same time, Dad, I think deep down, wanted me to be the traditional Cambodian son, which I was never going to be. But at the same time, he also recognised that I was born here, you know, Mum's Malaysian, and that I would adopt the Australian culture. And also I think there was part of him that wanted me to succeed in Australia, that was the idea that, okay, you've got this kid who's born in Australia and he'll go on to do different things, you know. So Dad, you know, I say to Dad, you can't have it both ways. You can't expect me to be a traditional Cambodian son and yet, you know...
Be Australian and succeed.
Be Australian, that I'm going to be born here and that will be my culture.
Yeah. I feel that a lot with my... my aunts, for instance, where there's a lot of like small Persian cultural norms that are just around like serving tea and serving sweets and that kind of thing. And as an unmarried younger woman in the family, like that responsibility falls to me often.
And then you don't do it.
And then yeah, exactly. And then I do it wrong, or like, you know, there's all these things. It's bloody annoying. Like, so you like serve everyone in kind of order of like the elders yes. in the family, but I also don't want to serve the men first. Like, come on, I'm born here and I'm a fucking feminist. Mm. Like, I'm not about this life. And so then I'll do things like that, and then I'll like see my auntie like giving me a look like, why didn't you serve that uncle first? And in my mind, I'm like telepathically trying to be like, well, your sister moved to Australia. I was born here. Like, there's so much in...
It's quite stark, isn't it?
Yeah, there's so many layers.
The rules are quite stark.
And they're almost unspoken as well. Like, I've had a similar experience growing up. Like, when I would stay with Dad, like me and my brothers would stay with Dad, he would be like, oh, well, you need to do the dishes now and you need to do these things. And I would, like you did, Jason, push back against him and be like, why do I have to do that? Why is it me? And then I go to a marae for the first time in my teens and I was like, oh, it's because this is how a marae operates, like a gathering place operates in Te Ao Māori. And at the time I didn't understand that that's what he was doing. He was bringing that tikanga, he was bringing that practice to the home, and he didn't explain it to me. He just asked me to do it and thought that I would fall in line, but I was a little rat bag. And I was like, no, leave me alone. Why don't the boys do it? Like a little gremlin.
And, yeah, and I think I didn't really get it. You know, I didn't really get the Cambodian side. You know, we would go to a lot of community events and, you know, New Year events, and because I didn't know the language, you know, I'd sit there and I would not know what the, you know, what the was going on. You know, like I didn't. And so that's quite, it's quite alienating in a sense, because you're in the culture, but then you can't connect to it because of the language and you don't know what's going on and you're just there, you know.
And as a kid, you're probably like, God, I'm bored.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Can we go home? Why am I here? Yeah.
Are we going to play any games? Yeah. What's going on, guys? Now, in your book, you talk about a trip to Cambodia that you took with your dad. Can you talk about how that was?
Yeah, it was a pilgrimage, really. I think I went to Cambodia in 2005 in my 20s, and the purpose of that trip was to film a news segment, a news story for SBS, because I was a cadet at SBS. And Dad helped me out with that. He helped with interpreting. And it was kind of a real road trip for us. But after many years as a child rejecting the culture, this was a chance for me to understand the culture a bit more. And Cambodia is an amazing place. It's a really magical place, you know, the temples and the culture. But at the same time, it has a very, very violent past. Not just the genocide, but historically, you know, the Khmer Empire was a very violent time, because it was quite tumultuous and there was a lot of takeovers and different cultures trying to take over Cambodia. But I think it gave me a stronger sense of connection to the history, and to also, and it also brought me closer to Dad. I think for him, it was showing me where he came from, and that, and I got a stronger sense of where I came from, because that was the origin, that they are my origins, right?
Days like these, I wonder where I'm going, where I'll be. Is this path I'm holding down, reflecting what I see?
And if I want. So a big part of your memoir is kind of delving into kind of rediscovering your mum. Essentially, can you tell us a bit about her as a person that you remember, and then the person that you discovered when you went on this journey in writing this book?
I think this book was very restorative for me, because as a child, I had this particular view of mum. I knew her as a very sad person. There was a sadness in her life, and she was also very unwell. And she was, you know, she'd sit on the couch staring into space, and she wasn't like the other mums. She, you know, I couldn't bring friends over because she wasn't like the other mums, and I kind of just accepted that that was who she was, and I didn't really understand the context. And then she died when I was 12, so I pushed that down and put up a barrier to protect myself and to also just put that away after she died. But then many years later, on the 20th anniversary of her death, all of these feelings about her sort of came back. And that's what sparked the book and the journey to try and understand who she was as a person. And there was a taboo or an unspoken mystery in my family around what happened to her in that first marriage. And obviously I've sort of given it away, but the memoir was the process of going back over that. And part of that was the question around my half-sister. Why did she exist? My half-sister lived in Malaysia. I didn't grow up with her. And so here I am growing up as a kid in Melbourne. There's this strange, mysterious girl living in Malaysia. And I only know about her through these letters that she's writing to mum. So she's a really abstract concept. I can't grasp her. She's not living in the house. She's not with me. I don't know who she is. I only know her through one photo. And so I don't really have a very strong connection when I was growing up to my sister. And that was the mystery. Why does she exist? And so after mum's death, I sort of put that away, embarked on this journey of trying to get back into contact with my sister, which was before the memoir, and then further down the track, diving more deeply into my mum's story and retrieving the letters which my sister had kept. And the letters really reveal everything about what happened in that first marriage and why my sister exists and my mum was the way she was. And I think what I'd like readers to take from this story is that you can't presume, you think you know somebody, but you might not know the whole story. And that's what this is about. It's about my understanding of a person, of mum, as I understand her as one way, but the truth of her story is completely different. And then understanding that truth completely changes my perspective of what she went through and why she was that way.
Because you know her as your mum, but beyond that, she had a whole other life.
Yeah, and I think I spent a lot of time punishing myself about that because I was only 12 when she died. But on the mum's side, there was, you know, they knew the context, mm-hmm. but I didn't know the context, and so I later felt very guilty about that because I didn't know the full story. But at the same time, on my mum's side, there was a lot of grief and sadness and unspoken tension around the first marriage, which I didn't know about.
And perhaps there's an element of them wanting to protect you from that as well as not dredge it up, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think it was mainly about not dredging it up because I think they were just so grief-stricken after she died that they wanted to put it behind them.
How do you feel about your relationship with your half-sister, Sarah, now?
Yeah, look, I mean, it is a pretty extraordinary relationship. And through this memoir, I think she's been able to speak up about her own experience as well. I think that she's felt that she hasn't been able to express these feelings about mum and about her own story and her own journey. And I think that we're much closer now, you know, I mean, going from, you know, who is this girl? Who is this girl in my life to having a deeper connection with her now?
Oh, I love that.
So you write this book, this memoir about all of your family history, and then you must have done so many different events and talks and things like that. What has the reception been like of the memoir?
I've been so proud of this book, and I've just loved listening to readers' feedback and connecting with people who have found something in the book. And what surprises me is the variety of people who are able to connect with the book. It's not just the usual suspects. I mean, there's a really strong queer following. You know, a lot of gay Asian men have contacted me saying, you know, that's exactly what I've been going through with my parents, you know, in terms of sexuality and parents accepting my sexuality. But then there are, you know, other people come to the book. You know, people in Brisbane, I remember there was a real variety of people at the launch. People came to it for for the issues of trauma, childhood trauma, or the migrant experience, or mental health, or, you know, Cambodian culture. So there's not one thing that people are coming to this for. And that's what I like about it, the fact that there's a broad appeal to it. It's very specific, but people are taking what they will out of the story.
We have a similar thing with the podcast, is that there's so many different people that listen to this, even though we're very specific and we're talking to mixed race people. You know, there are parents who are, you know, raising multiracial children. There are, you know, Pākehā people, white people who just want to listen in and understand the experience. There are obviously people of all different mixes listening in and messaging us and saying how beautiful it is, and how I've had someone the other day, she was like, I've taken a lot of language from your podcast and applied it to my therapy practice. And I was like, whoa, I don't know if we're the
therapy
people. Yeah. And I was like, A, first of all, where is that? And B, I don't know if we're the language setters.
You should put a disclosure.
Exactly.
This is general advice, not medical advice.
Or legal advice. So I really feel, you know, the same type of thing with our podcast as well. Now, I want to touch on something that you said about, like, gay Asian men having a chat with you about this and relating to you about this, because before you said, you know, the good Cambodian son, and I'm guessing that being gay doesn't fit into being the good Cambodian son. How has your father, you know, reacted to you being queer?
Yeah, I mean, look, the traditional Asian son is supposed to get married to a woman and then have children, and then, you know, the line is continued, you know, the hereditary line is continued. You're passing on the family name, and it's, you know, that very patriarchal view of the world. But obviously I didn't fit into that, and there was a lot of silence around my sexuality, because I was upfront with Dad very early on. You know, I in my 20s I came out to him, and I was very upfront about that, because I'd settled that within myself. This is who I am, and Dad, you're going to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the face of it, he did kind of accept it. He sort of went, he sort of said, But look, and at that time, I was living in Sydney, so I wasn't living with him. So I didn't really get a gauge of how he was dealing with it. So I thought, from my perspective, he's like, oh, okay, so our relationship was sort of ticking along, and it did just tick along. But deep down, he was confused about it, and much later he called me and said, you know, I'm getting old now, will you take a wife? And that really shocked me, because I thought we were already dealt with that. Certainly I'd already dealt with that. And that shocked me, because he was trying to arrange a marriage for me, which just came out of the blue, because we'd never talked about it. It was never in my mind, even though that's quite traditional for arranged marriages to happen. And, you know, I remember that when I was growing up, I saw my cousin in an arranged marriage. But I never thought it would happen to me. Here's my dad saying, I can ask for you. You know, I can, there's a woman I'm thinking about.
And I checked the gay box?
Exactly. And I thought, this is, you know, many, many years, and we've already dealt with this, Dad. Why are you coming to me now? So that blindsided me. And it blindsided me. And then the same sex marriage debate came around, and I confronted him about that, because I really needed him to vote yes. And I didn't know how he was going to vote, because I worried about that. And I imagined him sitting on the couch, watching the news, being bombarded by all of the, you know, anti-same-sex marriage campaigners. And I was thinking, what is he thinking? You know, what way is he going to go? And so I emailed him and I said, you know, this is really important to me. Really need you to vote yes. It would mean a lot to me, because, you know, I want to get married. And there was no reply. So there was no reply for some time. And then the reply came, and it sort of sat in my inbox for a long time. And then I finally got the courage to open it. And then he said, in the same-sex marriage debate, I will vote a yes. And you know, this debate is very complicated. And then in the email at the end of it, he sort of said, you know, Donald Trump had a great speech at the UN. He really spoke his mind. But I was incredibly relieved, and I think I did cry after I read that, because he finally came around after all of these years to understand, you know, who I am. Mm-hmm. And that was the real breakthrough for him. You know, it wasn't my coming out, it was his coming to kind of deal with that. And now, you know, and now he watches the Mardi Gras. You know, he watches me marching in the Mardi Gras, and he'll say, oh, yeah, I'm watching, you know, and he'll say, oh, they didn't show enough of you, and, you know, so it's a real, it's a real 360, really, yeah.
I love that. And now is he trying to arrange a marriage with you and a man?
Oh, I wish. I mean, would make my life easier. God.
I have so I'm queer as well, and like one of the kind of stereotypes when I think about like with gay men is like no fats, no femmes, no Asians. And how does that come up for you, or like how have you been navigating that?
Yeah, look, I think there, let's face it, there is an anti-Asian sentiment in the gay community, particularly among men. We have progressed a lot in this debate, you know. There's been a lot of debate about apps and what people put on those apps. Mm. Now I'm seeing less of the racial comments, which is a good thing. But now it's more coded. It's more I'm into beefy guys, or I'm into hairy guys, or I'm into bigger guys. And so that's coded. And so not necessarily that there is, you know, Asian men who are not hairy or beefy or whatever, but it is still coded. But you know, I kind of ignore that these days, and I don't really buy into it anymore. It doesn't really affect me as much as it used to. It did get me down quite a bit, you know, early on. That here I am. This is my body, and this is what I look like. This is the body that I have. So I'm trying to navigate this space where you do have to fit in to a particular body type, and there's a lot of that going on. It is essentially body dysmorphia. That's what it is. There are a lot of that going on. And there is a certain type about bigness and about being muscular, and that's still there. But I don't really buy into that anymore. But also, it also surprises me though who I attract. Mm. Yeah, because it just surprises me, because I do attract jocks and big guys, and so it's just strange to me that you know, I'm trying to reconcile those feelings, my early feelings of, you know, of my body, and I don't, you know, I'm a skinny dude, you know, but I do attract, you know, big guys, and I'm just thinking, why is that? And, you know, how does that work? You know?
So the stereotype doesn't ring all the way
true. No, it's changed. But again, it always surprised me who I attract.
And I think it's so interesting in the context of dating. I feel like for us as people that are multiracial, like, when I hear you say that, I'm like, oh, God, is there a racial element, though? Like, you're saying it's not coded. And I find this often when I'm on dating apps and people are talking to me in very particular ways, and I think I'm hyper aware that are you trying to exoticize me in some way? And it will come down to like really little things that we've talked about before, like if people make comments about my eyes or this kind of stuff, instantly that's a small red flag for me, and I'm like,
yeah. I mean, guys make presumptions of me, and they look at me and they make certain presumptions, and I won't say what those are, but they have particular stereotypes of Asian men, and but I think it is changing these days, and I'd love to have an Asian boyfriend, but it's actually, that's one of my pet projects at the moment. So I'm trying to get an Asian boyfriend, but it's proving to be really difficult. It's really hard. There are a lot more out there on the scene now, because, you know, 20 years ago when I was in my 20s and navigating the scene, there weren't any really, and there weren't any mixed race people either. I mean, still, like, even now, like, I go out there and I go, where are they? Like, where are the mixed race guys? There aren't not many. It's very small group of people. And I kind of think that I would love, I like this idea, because most of my, all of my boyfriends have been white. And I'd like this idea of actually dating another mixed race person. I'd like that. I'd like to explore that.
I've been on dates with mixed race people. I find it really fascinating because I find it a really easy way to get deep with someone very quickly.
Yes.
Because we have this shared experience immediately. And then the difficulty for me is I'm like, is there anything else there? Or do we just have this? And we can like very quickly get into like your family and your family histories and experiences of racism and basically this podcast.
Yes.
And then we finish those discussions and then I'm like,
you're bored.
I don't know if there's, you know, it's complicated.
Instead of going on a date, you're conducting a bean project.
But I agree that it also has been a pet project for me, is that I have dated a lot of white people and I have been interested in exploring dating other mixed race people.
Diverse
specifically.
Yeah, dating pool.
I certainly think that discussions, the temperature of discussions around race is much lower when you're with another mixed race person or someone who is culturally diverse. Definitely, that's for sure. I tend to think that with white boyfriends or white guys that there's a threshold. Like you can talk about race, but there's a threshold, and that if you keep on talking about it, they kind of tune out, and then it just, you know, there's a threshold that you cross, and that's been in my experience where they only have a certain threshold of being able to talk about it.
And also, I don't want to be someone's teacher. I'm bored.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Like, I just can't
right.
anymore.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a bit like that.
But it's been really interesting because I've seen a lot more on the apps, people putting the question like, can you guess my background and things like that.
No, it's,
I hate
that game.
Yeah.
It's, I hate that. I shut people down now because I still get it when people try to play, you know, the racial guessing game. It's like the Wheel of Fortune. They spin the wheel and then they try to guess a country and they try to guess the cultural background. I just go, now I just sort of go, oh, let's not play this game. I actually do just shut it down and go, let's not play this game and just laugh it off. But people do respect that now, and I don't get it as much as I used to, but it's still around. It's so strange because I go, this is something that I've been asked, you know, many, many times, and it's just a bit tiresome.
It's like pin the race on the person.
Yeah. Yeah, just speak to me. Like, speak to me about something else. Speak to me about, you know, the latest show on Netflix, or to speak to me about, you know, my views about something.
Or invite you to a podcast where you talk only about being mixed race.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I do want to talk to you about your experience being a journalist. In your book, you talk about starting out, and that at that time in the 2000s,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Like having a kind of racial gaydar for the what was it?
Echolocation.
Echo. Yeah. About having echolocation for the other Asian journalists.
Yeah, because because there were so few of them that you see them and you know who they are. Even now, it has changed over the 20 years that I've been in the business. It's much better now than it was when I started. When I started, it was, you know, very few. There were, you know, you could count the number of Asian journos on one hand, really. This is in the entire Australian industry, whereas now there's probably, you can count them on two hands, you know. but no, that's not true. There is more than 10 now.
Yeah.
It's actually, yeah, but because I was putting a list together. And it is more than 10. In the ABC, it's more than 10 now. So the ABC has been very, very advanced in terms of, you know, bringing more culturally diverse journos on. But the age gap between, say, me and the newer ones is something like 10 to 15 years. So I am the second longest serving on-air Asian talent at the ABC after Jeremy Fernandez. And I'm very proud of that mantle because it shows that I'm still around, I'm still relevant, you know, I'm still in, you know, still in the business. Very proud of that. But it also shows that change takes a long time. So it's taken a whole generation, you know, 20 years for me to be not just the only, you know, not the only Asian journo in the village. Now there are more, and I think that's a good thing.
You're kind of like an elder.
I am. I'm a veteran reporter. No, really.
That's a better way of putting it.
Yeah. But look, I mean, that's not to say that there weren't people before me, but there were only one or two people before me, and they were their Gen Xers. So it takes a lot of time. And I think that, you know, I know that the younger folk tend to think that there's, you know, not enough change. But when I look back, I look at these younger people and their progress has been rapid. You know, they've been able to advance in the last five to 10 years. Whereas, you know, I started 20 years ago and it was incredibly slow. Progress was incredibly slow to get ahead, you know, to be seen and to be treated as a great journo and to be seen for my work. It was incredibly hard. It was glacial, yeah.
And so you think that progress can happen more quickly now?
Yes, yeah.
That's exciting.
So I take a different view because now there's, you know, back 20 years ago, nobody talked about cultural diversity. There was no support for that. Now there are you know, media groups that advocate for this. Everybody's talking about it. You look, go on socials, everybody, you can't shut people up. You know, people are talking about race and cultural diversity ad nauseum. They are. And I think that we should have that discussion. I think there's still a long way to go, particularly in the upper ranks, because if you look at the executive levels of media organisations, there are no Asians. There's one Asian person in the executive at the executive level at the ABC, for example. But you know, you look across the board and there's not a lot, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like we had a similar conversation with Lizzie Hu about not the kingmakers, but the people at the
gatekeepers.
Yeah. And Comedy Fest and in the comedy industry as well. Is that like in the lower levels or the, you know, the kind of everyday levels of comedy, there's a lot of diversity, but then the higher you go up, the less that there is.
Yeah, and then you will have that issue around salary and pay, and that a lot of the, you know, these younger folk will be on lower salaries. You know, they're starting on lower salaries, and so you have to look at that, you know, because if you're trying to advance people, but you're bringing them on a lower salary, are they going to stick around? You know.
Yep.
Yeah. Attrition rates are real. And I think one of the things that I've been grappling with recently is that I think to a lot of media organizations in general, to be honest, like visible diversity is very important.
That's right.
And then you like peel it back one layer. And I've definitely been in teams where, yes, you can be the spokesperson and the face, and then literally everyone behind you is white.
Yeah.
And I'm so, like, let's talk about culturally safe spaces, okay?
There's a question around who's making the decisions, who's making commissioning decisions around stories, who's making decisions around hiring and firing. You know, there are questions around those issues. But again, you know, that I think it's time, you know.
Mm.
Yeah. What kind of stories are you excited to tell at the moment?
You know, I made a conscious decision early in my career not to do stories about Asian Australians or the LGBT community. And I think right now I've really enjoyed looking at those communities and doing more stories in those areas. And I don't see those stories as, you know, Asian stories or LGBT stories. I see them as legitimate topics of discussion. So, for example, I've been covering the Gay Hate Inquiry in Sydney, but I don't see that as a gay story. I see that as a crime story. That's about crime. It's about justice. I've also been doing stories about food delivery riders and the inequities in that industry. I don't see that as an Asian story. I see that as an industrial relations story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in my career, I've had to battle a perception that I'm just doing those stories because it's my thing. So I remember during the COVID, I was actually reporting on COVID before the pandemic started. So I was reporting on it back in January 2020, and I was doing a lot of those stories. If you remember, like, people were caught up, there were Australians stuck in China and in Wuhan. Yep. And so I was doing a lot of those stories, and someone commented that they thought that I was doing those stories because I was Asian. And it just happened that I was assigned to that, you know, at that time, and I had the lead on that. And then I pretty much held that lead for like 2 years. I was doing 2 years of pandemic stories, but somebody thought that I was doing those stories because I was Asian. And I thought, no, but this is not an Asian story. It's a global,
it's a health crisis. Yeah.
The biggest, yeah. Basically, one of the biggest stories in
our lifetime,
recent history. You know? and I think that's a misconception about, if people look at me and think that I'm just going to do those particular stories, they're wrong. Because if they look back at the 20 years of my stories, I've never advocated for a particular position or community. It's not about advocating. It's about doing a great yarn. Is this a story or is this not a story? That's how I approach it. I'm not approaching this, this is an Asian Australian story, so I'm going to do it. Some Asian Australian stories are really boring, so I'm not going to do it. Do you know what I mean? I'm not going to do a story about Chinese New Year, like whatever.
Happens every year.
Exactly. And it's working on 7:30, I mean, we would not necessarily do that because, unless there's something in it, And I think there is a misconception about that because only very recently have I done stories in those communities.
Has it felt good? Taking up that space?
Because I have a specialty in those areas. I have knowledge, cultural knowledge or community knowledge that provides me access to the community. And when you speak to those people, they feel much more relaxed speaking to you because you get them, or they feel that you get them. And I think that, it's not an advocacy position. It's a specialist position, like any specialty, whatever round you might have, it's actually a specialty, and that's an advantage.
Thank you so much for your time today, Jason. It's been so beautiful to talk to you about being all mixed up.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Being Biracial.
This podcast is hosted, edited, produced, all of the things, by us, Kate Robinson and Maria Birchmoronga.
The music that you're listening to is by the amazing Green Twins, and this is their song, Take It Slow.
We recorded this podcast on the lands of the Kulin Nation.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.